Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck nicks, what the fucksters, what the fuckadelics? That could go on for a while. Sometimes I don't know if I should keep doing it at all. But we're 10 years in, and it was sort of a carryover from something I did back in the day on Morning Sedition, a community builder. Now it's a habit, and now it's a signature thing, and I do it. I used to have lists of different WTF things, and I like doing it. So I don't know who I'm talking to. It's as if somebody just told me not to do it, and that person just lives in my head, that there was a moment there in the middle of doing it where I'm like, I'm doing this again, and then there was another voice that said, why? And then the out loud one said, because it's what I do. How's it going with you guys? Are you doing what you do? Are you holding on? The bottom line is the last several months, 4 years, have been hard for everybody. You know, I was shattered with some personal experiences that I'm getting through. But it's in all this vulnerability and in all this isolation, you know, that you know you start to see, and I've talked about this a bit before, that you kind of really get the sense of who you really are. And, you know, lately I've really been wondering if I've changed at all. You know, because I have this compulsion, my, you know, some of my old kind of desires to, like, I want to smoke cigars. You know what I mean? I want to be out in the world. I just, like, I can feel the discomfort and, you know, my sense of self is kind of fragmented. I find I'm insecure again. I'm obsessing about my weight and this and that. All the things that I used to do to try to somehow feel like I had control over my life by creating more aggravation for myself, more drama for myself, more reasons to beat myself up, that was somehow grounding to me through most of my life, and I've identified that. But now with Lynn gone and the fact that I was starting to believe her, you know, I was starting to believe her idea of me, and I think a lot of it was true, and I was trying to live in that, but now it's like it's a struggle. So the last few weeks have been sort of fraught with this idea that, like, you know, like, well, fuck it, man. Look at me. Maybe she was the best thing about me, even though it had nothing to do with me. You know, maybe, you know, I felt better when I was with her. And now look at me. I'm just the same old fuck I always was. And then I just beat myself up for one reason or another. And by the way, I have Glenn Close on today. Glenn Close. It's one of the only things that saves me is like I get to talk to amazingly talented people and enjoy that and wonder in the face of it, do I have any talent? Who am I? What am I? But you know Glenn Close from The Big Chill, Fatal Attraction, The Natural. Maybe some of you grew up watching her in 101 Dalmatians. She's currently in the new Netflix movie Hillbilly Elegy, which was quite a stunning performance on her part. And you know, Amy Adams, right? I get some of the Amys mixed up. Yes, Amy Adams. So that was great to talk to her. But this meditation thing keeps popping up, you know? I've been doing therapy. I've been doing EMDR to try to process, you know, some of the trauma of late and of early. I got to sit quietly. My therapist pointed out to me that negative thinking is sort of the animal thing that we have to choose against. I never thought about this way. A couple of things that happened the last week. I talked to John Densmore from The Doors, who in his book brought up something that I said to Gary Shandling, or Gary Shandling said to me. And I'm paraphrasing. It was like, people that can't sit in silence or with silence are addicts. And when you strip it down to that degree, like, you know, in, you know, to get to a place of silence, meditative silence, to not be able to do that is in and of itself addiction, to where you like, I have to distract. I have to get away from me. But the interesting thing that my therapist brought up was that on an animal level, we think negative. And I'm like, how is that even possible? Because we're conscious. I mean, negative is a value judgment. And she said, well, as an animal, your first, you know, all you're thinking is fight or flight. Really, that's your reaction to the world. You wake up and you're like, all right, here we go. So that translated into human, you know, is like fear and assumptions and negative thoughts. And then the beating yourself up, that's a different choice. That comes from parenting or lack of parenting. But like, when does this stop? When do I stop making mistakes? When do I fully fucking learn from my experience? I guess not until I live on a goddamn mountain by myself. But that's where the possibility comes in. Why can't I just sit with myself until I like myself? But this meditation thing keeps coming up. It kind of landed with me when Densmore took that section of my conversation with Gary Shandling, which I don't remember. And then the knowledge that Lynn used to meditate twice a day. And then my therapist saying that one of the things that it would enable you to do, if you sit with yourself, just learn how to do it, to meditate, is to accept yourself and maybe love yourself. See, that's the fucked up thing. I don't want to get into complaining. We have bigger problems in the world. Everyone's got their own burden to carry and to bear. You know, try not to dump it on other people. But why can't I just sit fucking quietly and figure that out? God damn it. I crave the peace of abandon. And it seems attainable if I just sit. I know what's up intellectually. I know who I am in my heart. I know my liabilities. I know my shortcomings. I know my sadness, my anger. I know all this stuff. And I live with it. And some days I accept it. But I need to get to the next place where I continue to honor myself through decisions, and also to maybe, and I don't even like to say it, to like myself, for fuck's sake, to love myself. See, I'm uncomfortable with even saying that. I'd rather just, you know, parade around on stage or on Instagram with you folks doing the emotional wrestling, doing the back and forth, doing the song and dance, doing the jokes, doing the anger, doing the guitar, doing this, doing that, doing the eating, doing the cooking, stripping the pans, starting things, not finishing things, loose ends, drama, terrified eating. God damn, I gotta get straight with myself in terms of acceptance, self-love, moving through feelings. It, like, there is such a fucking strong part of me that is so fucking young inside, childish even, and so afraid of being hurt. And that's, and I've talked about this before in my act. The monster I created to protect the child inside is hard to manage. That's, I mean, I can't get any truther than that. That's as truther as I can be. And it exists. Got to bring it. I got to get that kid out. I got to get that kid okay. I got to show that kid some love. And I got to fucking, you know, integrate and meditate. Yeah. This is what I'm left with after phase one of the grieving process. I'm left with me again. God damn, I'm going to make a cake. So look, Glenn Close was a surprising talk about things that, you know, I couldn't have imagined. It always is that way when I talk to people. I was happy to talk to her. I was thrilled to talk to her. I watched the movie Hillbilly Elegy. Obviously, I've seen many of her movies. But it was very engaged conversation, and she looks great. And I love her, and I love talking to her. She's in this new movie, as I mentioned, Hillbilly Elegy. It's got her, Glenn Close, Amy Adams, directed by Ron Howard, streaming on Netflix now. And this is me talking to Glenn Close. Hi, Glenn.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine. Are you still in Northern California?
I am in, I'm in Southern California.
Ah.
Where are you?
I'm in Bozeman, Montana.
Really?
It's snowing right now. Can you see?
That's exciting.
I know. It's great.
Yeah, we don't have real winter down here. It's just crisp. We just, it's like,
yeah,
this.
Yeah,
this
Chris, for you is like 62 degrees.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah,
people Chris are for us is -9.
People here are complaining about how cold it is, and it's, yeah, 63. Yeah.
You're a bunch of wusses down there.
Look, I lived in New York for long enough. I'm from New Mexico. I know what snow is.
Yeah.
I know what wind chill is.
Boy, can New York get cold. Oh my God.
With the wind chill? It's crazy. Oh,
but it's such damp. Cold.
Yeah, it's the worst.
Here's different. It's dry. It's not as bad.
It's nice. It's pretty. You can still enjoy the cold in Montana.
Yeah.
How long have you been up there?
Well, two members of my family, my two siblings, have been here for over 30 years.
Really?
My parents used to live, they're both gone now, but they were in Wyoming. So I was the only Eastern holdout for my entire working life until last Christmas when I moved here across the yard from my younger sister.
So you live on the same compound?
I wouldn't call it a compound. I'd call it two houses next to each other in a nice, fabulous, normal neighborhood.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, compound's a little menacing.
Well, compound sounds a little she-she.
Yeah, or a little scary. Either way, she-she, scary.
Oh, yeah, there are compounds out here that are scary.
I would think so, yeah. But wait, so do you come from Wyoming?
No, we all come from Connecticut, so originally.
Your parents just ended up in Wyoming?
My parents were black sheep, if there were ever black sheep. They both grew up basically in Greenwich, Connecticut.
Fancy Greenwich, Connecticut? Like
fancy Greenwich,
hoity-toity?
Well, well, now it's really different from when I was growing up. But anyway.
What's going on there now? I don't even know what's going on in Greenwich, Connecticut.
Well, I don't know either. But all these huge, 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 huge mansions all over the place with big, big walls and locked gates. And when I was little, we would, you know, get on our little feisty Shetland pony and ride all over the place, and you know, it was a totally different place.
The rolling hills of Connecticut or something.
Yeah, I mean, it was like the back country.
But your parents were black sheep. Wait, what was the situation there when you were growing up?
I mean we were lucky enough to my grandfather had a like 180 acres and
oh my God, that's like half the state.
he was, so we could have been in Iowa as far as we were concerned.
So that was that a compound? Were you guys?
I couldn't call a farm a compound.
It was a farm?
It was like a farm.
Legit farm. So your grandfather was in
chickens. And he wasn't in the farming business, but yes, I call it a gentleman's farm. Yeah. So we ran wild. And,
so was he a big landowner? What was he, like a corporate wizard, your grandfather? Was he from the Mayflower or something?
Well, other ancestors weren't on the Mayflower, but close behind.
No kidding. So old school America.
Yankees. Yeah, I mean, around the world, like Yankees, Yankee, you know, is not necessarily, it can be pejorative.
Right. No,
but,
I get it.
You know, it's yeah. You know, we real, yeah, die New Englanders.
Blue Bloods?
Yeah.
All right. So that's, well, that's kind of deep, right? I mean, yeah. to, to
yeah.
grow up
I
in
mean,
that.
Well, it's fascinating. I want to know everything about my family. I know my grandmother on my dad's side was in the Galveston flood.
Oh,
she
really?
Was 3 years old. Yeah.
And what? Tell me about that. What is the Galveston flood? I feel you said it
the
like
Galveston
I should know it.
The Galveston flood was still 8,000 people died. It's still the biggest natural disaster to befall this country.
Oh my God!
It was a storm surge that basically wiped out a huge section of Galveston.
So you have you had family from Texas?
Yes, Texas, Virginia.
And that was your mom's side?
My dad's side.
Who's the one that goes back to in the Connecticut?
Well, the closest do. There's a Thomas Close house on Lake Avenue in Greenwich, and that goes, you know, back to...
Way back.
Way back, yeah, yeah.
So would you say that they were like, you know, old school, kind of waspy, you know, was it a...
Yeah.
You kind of lived in that world. That's exciting. That's what you
that's why I say my parents were black sheep because we did not live in that world. They quit the country clubs. You know, we didn't have coming out parties. None of that stuff. They weren't into that. No.
Rebels. Mm-mm. What did they do? What was your dad? What was your dad's gig?
My dad was a surgeon.
Oh, mine
he went,
too.
He went into the war.
Yeah.
And he flew with the Army Air Corps in France.
Yeah.
And when he came back he went to Columbia, became a surgeon.
What kind of surgeon? Then, general?
General surgeon, yeah. Is your dad a general surgeon?
Orthopedic. Hammers and
good.
Saws. Yeah.
A nothing lot of, like a good orthopedic surgeon. Yeah, my dad did everything. I mean, it's a long story, and I, you know, it could be the entire
show
interview. But, you know, they ended up going, he went to the Congo in 1960.
Really?
With a kind of a quasi-missionary type group. And he spoke fluent French. So when the mutiny broke out, he stayed. Walked into the big hospital there and said, put me to work. I'm a surgeon. All the Belgian surgeons were leaving.
Huh.
And he worked all through the mutiny and stayed for 16 years in the Congo. And then when they came back, they went to the least populated county in the least populated state, which was Sublette County, Wyoming. And he became the town doc for the last 25, 30 years of his life.
Wow, that really is black sheep business there. So you lived in the Congo as a kid?
I visited the Congo.
Oh. Yeah. Like, were you already, like, too old? No.
That's a story. They got into a kind of a cult group. So
Christian,
you know,
cult?
This is why we don't want to go there.
Too far?
Well, it was supposed to be for everybody, you know.
Yeah.
If you were a good Muslim, be a good Muslim. Good Christian, be a good Christian. But basically, it was like any other cult. You know, well, we're going to remake the world in our...
No kidding.
Image.
So you were old enough to say I'm not fucking doing that?
No.
Oh.
I wasn't.
Sorry.
I didn't get out of it till I was 22 and I went to College of William and Mary as a freshman when I was 22 years old.
Was it a revelation that you realized it was a cult, or were you like, this is bullshit, I got to get out, thank God I'm in college?
Yeah, it was that.
That. Oh. And did they?
I mean, a revelation. I mean, it was always incredibly controlling. So I didn't know what I didn't know. I just knew I was ignorant.
Oh, okay. So you didn't know you were in a cult per se. It was just the life.
Well, I felt very separate and different from people.
Oof. What was the name of the thing?
Moral Rearmament.
Wow.
Or MRA. Yeah.
Wow.
I used to not be able to talk about it at all because I felt like there was a stamp on my forehead.
Right.
And I felt a sense of terrible shame. It wasn't my fault.
Right.
But I felt terrible shame. And it really wreaked havoc with me and my siblings. I you know, but that's why it's a long story. But, you know, it's devastating to go through something like that when you're that young. It's a mind fuck, and it's real psychological abuse, basically. And
oh, for sure. Was there a leader?
You don't know who you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that was the whole thing, huh?
Oh, the leader. Yes, it was on your birthday. You got ushered into this room and you were given a little, this is when we stayed in Switzerland for 2 years, given this little embroidered Swiss hanky. It was like you were being given, you know, gold. It was just, oh, when you think about it, it was so ridiculous. and I remember as a little girl, we would all have to have work shifts. And if you were got lucky enough to work in Uncle Frank's dining room, and you could set the table. And of course, it had all the best crystal and silverware. But you felt like you were the anointed. I mean, it's the same kind of thing that is so powerful.
Yeah. But it's interesting, isn't it, that your parents, like, being, you know, sophisticated, educated people, kind of like got involved with that? Isn't that?
Well, kind of- you know, I mean, this is everything. You know, the thing was, my mom didn't finish high school. They got married when they were 18. Dad, Dad had a very, very good. He went to St. Paul's, then he went to Harvard, but left to go into the war. And then he had a great education, and he also had, as a child, had been sent at 7 years old, which I think had huge repercussions on how he looked at the world, but went to English schools.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay.
From seven on, you know.
So he was like, he was away from his parents and just left to the institution.
Right. Yes. His dad was the director of the American Hospital in Paris. Hmm. So that's why he spoke French. I mean, so it's fascinating. It's really fascinating. And I've been able to come to terms with it. But it's still, I have trigger points that I've become aware of, and I just know what kind of people to stay away from. It's not healthy for me.
Well, I mean, you got to be, like, there's an element of that now that I think everybody tries to reckon with. Like, you know, how do these people allow themselves to be brain fucked by bullshit and commit to it wholeheartedly? It's hard to understand.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to, I think my parents, when they got sucked into it, were at a very, very fragile point in their marriage.
Oh.
You know, and I think this group fills in where you are the weakest and tells you, come in and believe what we believe and we're going to change the world.
Higher purpose.
I mean, I think as humans, we're very susceptible to that because we're born into this world. You know, we don't know where we come from. We don't know where we're going. We don't know who we are.
Yeah.
And depending on what kind of strength you get from your parents,
upbringing,
it's how you can deal with it.
Yeah, that's the vulnerability.
How you can keep your individuality. And I do think, because I was born, I'm very much an introvert. I've been in my head since I was little. So I had a very active, imaginative life. So I don't think they ever got me there. But they got me in a lot of other ways. They, I mean the group, not my parents.
But your parents obviously needed some parental, like they had a gap in their parent, how they were parented. Because that you need that sort of like...
My dad was, I mean, basically, he was abandoned. When you send a seven-year-old?
Right, yeah.
You know, it's crazy.
So you were able to hide your inner life, and you knew that instinctively, that was sort of yours.
Well, you become a little soldier. Yes, yeah. I do. My other of my siblings, one, my younger sister was too young, but my other siblings had their own ways of rebelling, but I don't have the DNA of a rebel.
No?
I guess I've learned it in a way, but...
You more retreat inward?
I'm more of a pleaser.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. How can I help? How can I help you with your... with your
tumbling? Who do you want me to be? Who do you want me to be? I can be that. Yeah, I can be that. Ooh, I'm not that. Oh, I better get out of here. But every single relationship I've ever had.
And that's
who do
your
you
love
want
life.
Me to be? Oh, I can be that. Oh, I'm not that. Help!
Yeah. And hopefully as you get older, it takes less time to realize you're not that.
Shall I say, I had a very empty toolbox. And I haven't always known the right tools to put in it, but, you know, I think I'm at a pretty good place in my life now.
You seem good. You're exuding.
I feel great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like because I was thinking. Well, that explains a lot about because the one thing that I was thinking about before I talked to you is the range of women that you have been in acting. It's kind of crazy that if you really think about all the different real extreme types of emotional monsters that you've brought.
Monsters!
Some of them.
Only one monster, that's Cruella.
Okay.
Otherwise.
No, but you have to bring humanity to people that are troubled and mentally, you know, fragile and have real shortcomings that can be dangerous. But also, you know, you're really good with the maternal force as well somehow. So I don't know where you tap into all that, but I guess this needing to be somebody for somebody must have informed the early acting intent.
You know, I really don't know because I think that love of pretending,
yeah,
which it is when you're a child,
right?
In the early days, you know, before I was seven, we had this wonderful landscape to run on and imagine on, and we did. I was a cowboy. And we played with puppets, You made up things. You
sure.
made up your games and who you were and where your hideout was and who are the good guys, who are the bad guys. You know, it was all, and it's all so healthy for a child to do that. But I loved fairy tales.
Yeah.
I loved even the scary ones. I'd pretend I was a little match girl, you know.
Oh, yeah.
The more kind of forlorn, the better.
Yeah.
And then I loved the great classic Disney animated features.
Especially Snow White,
because yeah. the Wicked Witch was so incredibly scary. And then I got to play a Wicked Witch later as Cruella.
A Disney witch, right?
Yeah, a Disney witch. It was so, so wonderful. So I'm doing what I should be doing.
Well, I mean, in that moment that you were able to go to college to sort of escape from, you know, get out from yeah. under this weird, shameful life that you had to hide. Like, I imagine that at that moment, like, that must have just been mind-blowing. Because, I mean, that was in the 70s, too, right? So a lot of shit was happening.
1970.
So, like, the world was blowing up expressively. You know the youth of the country was kind of,
yeah.
like, music, art, you know, taking
but I,
risks.
But I had been caught in a very conservative group.
Right. So it must have been just explosive when you got... What college did you go to?
Yeah, William & Mary, Virginia.
What was the campus like there? Were people were the young people really were they pushing the envelope at Williams?
It wasn't like Berkeley or anything like that.
But that kind of spread around a bit, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. But I wasn't kind of, you know, I just lived in the theater department. Uh-huh. I have to say, I wish now I'd been more of a rebel. But you have to remember, that kind of rebellion was not built into me.
Right, right.
So I had to find it. It took me a long time. Long, long, long time. But what I had was the theater.
And so that was what you studied there the whole time you were there?
I studied theater. I majored in theater and anthropology.
Anthropology.
But of course, it was like, literally, it was like water in the desert. I had a brilliant Bio 101 professor. I thought, oh, God, you know, he'd talk about mitochondria and that's right. all we know. I'd say, no! Yeah. No, I want to know more.
Yeah.
But I never could have gotten through chemistry. But
I couldn't either.
You know, just it was like everything, philosophy,
yeah.
you know, French drama, English literature, poetry, which still kind of intimidates me in a way. There's yeah. always the girl who got the meaning, kind of. But
yeah, but they're liars. You know.
No, it was fantastic. And I had a little dog, Penny, with me, and she'd trot, you know, behind me.
In college?
Yeah.
Penny? You brought a dog to college?
Yeah.
That's nice.
I did.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah. In fact, my senior year, at Phi Beta Kappa Hall. Phi Beta Kappa started at William & Mary.
Uh-huh.
And so there's their theater. It was a beautiful, beautiful, I think they're now redoing it. I hope they, but anyway, their theater was where I lived, and Penny was very much a part there. And I heard my senior year, or after I graduated, that the faculty had gotten together and realized that there were too many dogs in the building and they'd better lay down the law and not allow dogs. And then there was this pause, and then somebody said, but what about Penny?
The important
so
dog.
I think they, yeah, so they didn't, I don't think they changed the rule till after we were gone.
That's wild. I never saw any dogs in college. I guess it was a different time.
There should be more dogs in college.
I think so.
Not be in their high anxiety and stress. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, my little soulmate's just lying right over there.
You got one?
One yes, dog? I have Pip, Sir Pippin of Beanfield. Yes.
Ah, yes. What kind of dog is Pip?
Pip is a Havanese.
Oh, I don't even know what Pippi. That looks like.
Wait. Oh, he's, well, they're like, Havanese can come in all different colors, but he was born gray and black, and now he's white.
Old?
No, he's 5.
Oh, that's not bad.
No, he just turned white. I don't know.
It just happened?
Yeah.
So when you get there, like when you start doing the theater work, you had no real experience with it before.
Well, in the group, they had theater, but that they used to spread the message, and they go on these missions with their theater things. But the
like what? Like a singing group?
Yeah. Well, no, it was an actual. They had plays
in the cult.
Yeah.
Huh.
And there was a children's play called Bungle in the Jungle, and I played a tiger once. And I loved it probably too much. You weren't supposed to like it too much.
For the wrong reasons. You just like the acting.
You know. Because, oh, I feel this is cool.
I'm a tiger.
It's not cool. It's not about you. No.
And what, these were morality things?
Believe I'm laughing at it. What?
It's good to laugh at. Message? They had a message, the plays?
Oh, everything had a message.
Was it a recruitment tool?
Yeah.
Wow. You were in. I'm so surprised I never heard of the cult. So that was your early theater experience, and other than that, you didn't do any acting in high school or anything?
Let's see. Well, I went to Rosemary Hall from 10th grade on, because we came back to this country, and I was in the drama club, and they had an outdoor amphitheater that was fabulous. It was an all-girls school, but every spring semester, we'd put on a Shakespeare play in the amphitheater.
Oh, okay.
And my senior year, I was Romeo. And oh, I was good. In the Merchant of Venice and blah, blah, blah. Yes.
Did you get Shakespeare early on? I mean, did it resonate with you? Like, I mean.
No.
Yeah, I've had a very hard time with it. And I'm getting better, yeah. But I don't practice or anything.
Well, if the actor understands it, the audience will understand it. I think.
It's just a matter of staying in the saddle. I mean, it's hard to listen to. It goes on a while. You know what I mean? It's like, oh my God, they're still talking about, what are they talking about now? I checked out for 3 seconds. I don't know what's happening. That's my problem.
Yeah.
So in terms of training, was there someone that changed your life down there in college?
Yes, Howard Scammon. He was the head of the theater department. He was an absolute drunk. And
yeah.
I did my first audition, you know, literally when it was for Twelfth Night. And I was in chemistry class, or I was in bio, but we were in the lab. And Mr. Scammon had this kind of wild white hair, and he wore flip-flops and, you know, kind of sherbet-colored Bermuda shorts. And he peeked around the corner of the door of the lab and asked if I was there. And I went up to him, and he said, I just want to make sure you know you have a callback. So I got the role of Olivia in Twelfth Night. And over the great thing about going to a liberal arts school is that kids from all over the campus would participate in the theater project. So you couldn't really be a snob about what you were doing. You just tried to do it.
Right.
I really liked
that. Yeah.
There were kids who were there just because of the love of it, not because they wanted to make it their career. And yet there was a triumvirate at that time that were, they could have been in any acting school at, you know, and Howard Scammon, boy, he was what a character he was, but he sensed the seriousness of my intent. And I remember he said to me, as I became kind of, you know, a star at that time of maybe the William & Mary Theater, though you would have a starring role, then you'd have a very, very secondary role, and then you'd do costumes, and then you'd do, you know, sets.
Theater community stuff.
But I remember him saying to me at one point, just remember, you're a big fish in a very little pond.
So he was a real champion of yours.
He was. He helped me. We did they did at that time at Williamsburg this outdoor called The Common Glory, this outdoor drama about the revolution, and you know, and so, but it did it was an amphitheater, a true amphitheater. They didn't have any sound system, and he helped me really with my vocal range, my speaking vocal range. And then my senior year, I've always loved Katharine Hepburn because she's from Connecticut. Her father was a doctor, and I've always felt, unlike me, that she knew who she was. You know, I always had great respect for her. She was kind of one of a kind, you know.
Right, right.
And original, and didn't apologize for it. And I was doing sets, some painting sets, you know, it was my senior year. And for some reason, there was a television on, and it was that Dick Cavett, the only time that Hepburn was on television, being interviewed by Dick Cavett. And something in me, I mean, I always knew what I wanted, but at that moment it says, okay, if that's what you want to do, do it. And the next day I went to Dr. Scammon's offices, and I had heard about the URTA, TCG, national auditions. And I said, would you, nominate me, write this letter. It was the last day the letter could be postmarked for that year. And I went to those series of auditions, and I got my first job.
In New York?
Well, the finals for the, I think the TCG, one of them. One TCG was the all the college theaters.
Oh, okay.
And then the URTA was all the nonprofit theaters.
Okay.
And it must have been theater communications groups. That's a nonprofit, the TCG. And I got my job with a Phoenix theater that had three shows on Broadway. And so my first job was understudying on Broadway.
Really? That's amazing. Yeah. I like how that your the voice that told you to do it was actually Katharine Hepburn's voice, I think.
Yes, but also before Nike, or what was it, Just Do It? What was that? He used to stand in the wings and just say, just do it.
That was what's his name? The teacher?
Howard Scammon.
Yeah.
And after I graduated, I think the year after I graduated, and I was going into the old Helen Hayes Theater.
Yeah.
For my first job.
Was it like 46th Street or something? 40, where was it?
40, like I think it was 46th Street. It was right across from the Lunt Fontaine. And I saw somebody hovering in the shadows, and I looked over and I said, Dr. Scammon? And I went up to him, what are you doing here? And he said, I just wanted to see you walk into the stage door.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah, and then he sent me a little Jefferson cup, you know, with the name of the play, and sent me very, very, he'd come to see everything I did, and then he would send me really, really good notes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So this is throughout your early career. So you're doing Broadway.
Yeah.
And he's coming to see everything. And really, so he really was like invested and seemed to love you.
He did. And I loved him.
And was that really the foundation of your the training that sort of built you still?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I never went to acting school.
That was all of it, huh? What about singing? Where'd you learn how to sing so beautifully?
I don't want to go into that.
Really? That's the...
No,
that's
it's
the,
just... Well...
I've always sung.
I've always sung. But I went into a group that was an offshoot of MRA, and it was in that group for 5 years. And it was
from that
Up With People. You see?
You're a real trooper.
I'm feeling a little bolus of shame even as I say that, because I have no control. So I find myself on the girls bus, you know, for 5 years with Up With People.
I didn't know that was involved. Everyone knew Up With People, but not everyone knew that cult. But
yeah,
it came out of
MRA.
No kidding.
Yeah.
How do we get you past this shame? You have to let go of the shame, Glenn.
Well, I've just talked about it. So, but that Up With People, oh my God. Yeah. I just had a dream the other day, and this is really cool. I just had a dream, and I was in a, I've been doing a show, but it was really radical, and it was supposed to be Up With People. And then I was exhausted, and I was in kind of a room. It's almost like a hospital room. And the leader came in with a little, you know, henchman, and said, "Oh, we're going to go to Europe." I said, "I'm not going. This isn't what I do."
Yeah.
In my dream, and I've gone through a whole series of dreams, and it was so much fun, because in my dream I just was, are you kidding? I'm not going to go there. It's not what I do.
You actually were standing
in my dream, and then the guy had all these buttons. His little henchman had all these buttons on his suit. I said, "What are those buttons?" He said, "They're from a Burgermeister." The Burgermeister. And the thing was, in Switzerland, they get these people to come, like these VIPs, and they'd be Burgermeisters of, you know, some town in Germany or Holland or something, and they'd suck up to them and everything. And so the fact that in my dream, all these years later, the word Burgermeister would come up was hilarious.
Wow. Yeah.
It was hilarious.
And in your dream, you're standing up for yourself.
Yeah, I'm just saying. I wasn't even angry. I've had raging dreams where you wake up gasping for air. But this was just, are you kidding me?
Yeah, I'm over it.
Go away. Go away.
So it was based in Switzerland. That's where the big
one of the bases was Switzerland. They had a fancy place in London. They had a fancy place in L.A.
They had a big house
in Tucson. You know what? I don't even want to look it up. I don't know where it is.
Okay.
I don't want to know about either of those organizations.
I think you've freed yourself, and you've done very well. And you are a authentic, unique voice and person.
Yes. Okay. So we can move on.
Yes.
Well, you know, it's interesting, because I do. I've always felt that art comes out of somewhere, a sense of outrage, that really touches people. And I certainly have had my bolus of outrage. And I think it's pretty much a bottomless ocean.
Sure. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I can always tell. I used to do a bit about that. There's a river of rage that runs through me always, but it's your choice to put the kayak in the water. You know, but it's always there. it's always there for a resource, you know?
Well, luckily, mine's a more, maybe a little bit of a calmer thing than a river on a kayak. But
yeah. Maybe just a gently paddling down the Rage Creek.
Maybe a lake, because the ocean is a little bit scary.
Just
mine's a New England lake with, you know,
an angry lake. So I guess, like, going to New York at that point must have been sort of jarring and exciting.
Oh, it was thrilling. I still was living at my grandmother's house in Greenwich, and I'd take the train in and get lost. I want to be a New Yorker. I'm going to take buses or subways, and I'd end out in Queens, you know, and we were rehearsing down on West 18th Street. And I, you know, it's like, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. Well, that's fucking true.
Just getting someplace.
What
was the first show? That was the first play.
Congreve's Love for Love, a restoration comedy. That was 1974.
So you were really a theater actress for a decade before you did movies, almost.
I think it's about 6 years.
Huh.
Because my first movie was Garp.
Well, who were the people that were like, you must have showed up in New York and there must have been the whole community was like, who's this kid? Who's this woman?
Like, well, I mean, that's a whole other story because Hal Prince was the director of That Love for Love. And yeah. I understudied a beautiful English actor, Mary Yore, and my best friend still, Mary Beth Hurt. Thank God I never had to go on for her. But the Saturday before our opening, Hal was at the theater, at the stage door when I came in, and he took me out on the stage, and he said, I'm thinking of letting Miss Yore go.
Wow.
I'll make up my decision during this matinee. So stay in your dressing room after the show. Everybody always disperses immediately, go get dinner between the shows. Stay in your dressing room, and if you hear over the intercom that you're wanted down in costumes, I've made my decision, and I want you to go on tonight.
So, what?
Yeah.
And did it happen?
It did, and I'd never had an understudy rehearsal. But the thing was, I was so green and hungry that I went to every single rehearsal, and for some ungodly reason, I knew the lines, because usually you start understudy rehearsals after the show is opened.
Uh-huh.
So I went on that night. They tried to find everybody and bring them back so we could at least walk through it. And I got through it, and I, you know, finished the run for that show. And then it was not true repertory in that we did one play after another.
Right.
But then I went up to the fourth floor dressing room again and became an understudy. So it was tragedy for Mary Yore, who died the following spring. And in a profession that is so, can be so cruel and so demanding, it was a profound lesson at the very beginning of my career. She wrote me a note. She had the grace to write me a note before I went on that night. And in that note, she said, be brave and strong. She didn't say break a leg or, you know, she said, be brave and strong.
That's heavy.
Yeah. What a gift she gave me.
Yeah, to be that giving in that moment, Jesus.
Unbelievable.
And that was the beginning of it.
That was my first step onto a professional stage.
And then you went on to do so much. I mean, like, I don't know theater as well as I know movies, but I have to assume at that time in the 70s you were seeing that world of those actors that were like who were around, the people
all
you worked
us, John
with,
John Lithgow,
and
practically everybody in The Big Chill, Kevin Kline, you know, all of us started, Meryl, you know, Mary Beth, Mandy Patinkin, who else? Everybody.
That's such an amazing bunch of talented people.
Yeah, pretty fierce.
Really? I mean, like, it's sort of, I think there's plenty of talented people, you know, now, obviously, but I think everything seems different. There seems to be a crew of people that happened in the 70s that have some sort of integrity that kind of lasts, and they're very defining, but that just might be because of my age. Maybe there's plenty of 20-year-olds that are along the same trajectory.
You know, I think starting out in theater gives you a depth of craft that you do not get if you start out in television or film.
Yeah.
I think they're great film actors, they're great, you know, but stage, it's you and the audience and your craft. And there's nobody to edit you, there's nobody, you know,
you got one shot.
Yeah.
Every show, every line.
8 times a week, a different audience every night, and you go out and deliver. And there's a discipline about it. You get there on time. You do your own makeup, unless it's complicated.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't, you get docked. You know, it's a discipline that has followed me these 46 years into how I approach everything still.
And when you say craft, because like when I watched Hillbilly Elegy the other night, and it's a tricky movie, you know, it's heavy and it's, you know, kind of gut wrenching. the characters, the character you played and Amy Adams played, unapologetic and broken, but human. Did you like assess that material and say, like, you know, if we don't embody these characters perfect, you know, in as humans, you're on the edge of something that could be kind of farcical.
Yes, because I mean, you think of Hillbilly, which I right. now I say mountain, you know, the mountain people. Right. Most of us know him as a cliche.
Right. Right.
And which is tragic. And
it is
I think
tragic.
Ron's whole purpose in wanting to tell this story, and he will say that he had, you know, his people come from Oklahoma. So it was, he called his grandmother Mama. You know, it was this whole mindset that a lot of us have just said, oh, that's a cliche. And then we read about the opioid crisis and the poverty and the violence. So yes, I think the intent was always to take that family and make them human. And, you know, all great drama comes from family. And, mm-hmm. and I think in creating something very specific, the people then can make broader. They can relate it to themselves.
You know, and that's rare that you see those type of people on screen that where they're not played as rubes or villains of some sort.
Or bad people. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that definitely worked.
Good. Yeah. I mean, it was an amazing process. He also, you know, we were very grateful, first of all, for Ron and all his prep, which is always just astounding. But also Netflix gave us the money to have at least 3 weeks of preparation. So we had time to go to Middleton, Ohio, and meet the family, see the neighborhood, you know, long before we went there to shoot. And we met whatever members of the family that were there. Each of us had individual time with them to ask whatever questions we thought were pertinent to the characters we were playing. And it just was invaluable. And we all felt it was incredibly brave for that family, especially Bev. And, you know, Amy speaks to this, to agree to let strangers come in and play you. I mean, and to play you as honestly as they could.
Especially what she went through. I mean, that's
what she went through.
Heavy.
Yeah. So, and I think because of the humanity of the story, that you will find empathy in places that you might not have had it before.
Well, I think that was the amazing thing about how everybody played it and how it was put together. You know, like your character, you know, from the outset, you know, you go through this arc with her where you're like, oh, what a nice old lady. And then you're like, ugh, maybe not, you know. and then you get into that familial darkness that drives, I think, what you said before, drama. You know, that there's a history there. Mm-hmm. That, you know, becomes revealed as the story unfolds. But yet, the empathy stays.
There are no real villains. People, it's just the gray of human life, you know? I mean, Mama had made terrible mistakes with her children.
Right.
And she didn't want her children, she didn't want to see it happen to JD.
Right. And there's that one scene, I don't want to spoil anything, where, you know, there's a flashback of, you know, what your character went through as a young, and it was like, oh my God, it's like one of those moments where, like, I could see how, I didn't read the book, but that was, you know, you're like, that was the window into the darkness, right?
Yeah. Deeply traumatizing for children. But also, I mean, the truth is
for anybody, I think.
That she and Papa lived, you know.
Separately.
They lived separately because he had, you know, he played around and he was, you know, and she never dated or saw anyone else.
Right.
But he would come and spend most of his days at her house and then walk home.
In real life.
Yeah.
Well, it must be amazing that the process of actually having to spend time. I don't know how many times you did that. And you did it with, I don't know, you didn't have the same opportunity with Von Bülow, but to actually, you know, get involved with the family that you're portraying.
That was the opposite with that when I played Sonny Von Bülow, and it was tragic for me. Understandably, everybody around her who knew her, and she was still alive up at New York Presbyterian, wouldn't talk to me.
Oh.
And I understand that, but I do feel that if they had, I would have played her. It would have helped me. It would have only made my performance better.
Sure.
But
to have this opportunity to sort of integrate and engage and spend time with and understand the emotional history of the characters you're playing, that must be more pressure in a way. I mean, it must be relieving in some way, but more pressure.
Yeah. My questions were, how did she sit? How did she change the atmosphere and she walked into a room? How did she hold a cigarette? She always used her hands a lot. If anything, I kind of tamped it down a bit because she was truly larger than life. And she was a much bigger woman than I am, taller. But it was incredibly helpful to try to, in my imagination, put all those elements together.
And those are decisions you have to make based on your own imagination without this resource. Like if you're playing a fictional person, those are the questions you still ask yourself.
Well, that's the fun of it. Yeah, the fun of it.
Is all these, minute-to-minute choices around behavior and engagement.
And a lot of times, I mean, I remember when I worked with Mike Nichols, he said, it's really, really good to have secrets. Huh. And so a lot of times you can have something in your head that's a secret that might be in your either imagination or, for example, something like House of the Spirits, where I had entire book as a Bible in a supporting role. You can have things that might trigger a certain behavior or reaction that the audience might not totally understand, but it will make it intriguing. You know, it will.
Interesting. It will,
yeah. So I think secrets are good.
So that's sort of different than backstory, really. Like, because that's a character choice. Like, somebody can hand you a backstory for a character, like, or have a couple of pages of where they come from. But to actually choose something that defines them emotionally, that is unspoken.
Yeah, from that backstory, there might be certain events.
Mm. You do a lot of backstory work when you do the stuff?
Usually, yeah. if I feel a need. When I did Damages, it was the first time they wouldn't allow me to do a backstory because they didn't know where they were going to go. very disconcerting, because I'd done beginning, middle, and end. And this was, you sign up for 6 years. We did 5 years. But it was a great exercise. And those writers, they were so brilliant. And I just said, just promise me that you don't compromise me in a way that I'm not aware of. That you don't have me say something and then turn it around, three episodes from now. And they never did.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
You're able to trust them. But like over time, like it just struck me because I remember seeing, like when I was younger, I remember seeing Garp. And I remember, like, when you mentioned that you had a sort of when you were a kid, you were sort of an inner kid, and you entertained yourself with your imagination. Robin was a lot like that.
Mm-hmm. We got to be real friends in that movie that lasted our whole lives. Not friends that called each other every week, but friends that, time fell away whenever I saw him. It was that kind of experience.
Well, it feels like you had sort of a similar, a little bit similar background in that. He was an only child, though.
Yeah.
But but he did come from a big world.
Yeah, but he was very much an introvert.
Yeah, well, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I knew him from comedy, and I interviewed him years ago, and he was a very shy guy, really, strange way.
I remember early on, I think when we were shooting up in Millbrook, the school stuff, and a whole bunch of press had come up, and Robin was doing press, and they asked me to go with him just for kind of moral support, I guess.
Right.
And he was really quiet, and it was one of the most amazing demonstrations of brilliance as he, when he spoke in front of the press, he brought in, you know, what was happening in the world. I mean, all this stuff. And I'd never seen him read a newspaper. And and it was just astoundingly brilliant. And he came off and he looked at me and said, "Was that okay?"
Yeah, that's sweet. And then, I remember, the Big Chill had a profound effect on me somehow. Mm. I'm younger, but that movie seemed to.
Are you saying you're younger than me?
I'm not. I'm the tail end of the boomer thing.
Oh, okay. I'm getting to where everyone is younger than me. Okay.
I'm 57. I wasn't.
Wow.
Yeah.
I want to be 57.
But that movie was for better or for worse, it kind of set the ball rolling of what a boomer was.
Yeah.
That it defined the spectrum.
Yeah.
And somehow or another, I don't know what it's like working with Kasdan.
Oh, great.
But that was to me, it was really the second film where you played a maternal force.
The second, yes. Yes. Absolutely.
I mean, that was the idea of that character, right?
Yeah, I wanted to play Mary Kay's part.
Right, yeah.
You know, but I remember he had a reading in New York. He brought some of us in. It was really kind of, oh my God. My dear, brilliant friend Mary Beth had been married to Bill Hurd, and she had just broken up with Kevin Kline. And she read it was just fraught. She read the part that Mary Kay Place got. So it was all, but I, after that reading, I went up to Larry and said, "I bet you want me to play, you know?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Okay."
But you held it down. You were the anchor.
And I dated Kevin. We all dated Kevin.
Yeah.
But it was great because we stayed friends. And so it was no big deal. You know, it was great.
But Hurt, so you, are you friends with Hurt still, William?
I am when I see him. It's that kind of friendship, but I don't have the kind of friendship that, you know, you call regularly. My best friend is Mary Beth still.
Well, so you can't. Yeah.
Oh, no, I can. I mean, you know.
Everything's water under the bridge at this point?
For me. I mean, she didn't do anything to me.
No, but I mean, but they don't get along like Mary Beth and William.
Oh, I think they'd probably be civil, but no.
Oh, I just can't, that whole crew, where he just seems, everybody seems so defined, and he seems so intense. I was kind of obsessed with him.
He was intense. I mean, he was incredibly intense. He and Larry had big fights because he wanted to stay looking like that drug dealer the whole movie, because everybody had said how beautiful he was, and he was beautiful, and he didn't want, I guess, he didn't want to clean up. He thought it'd be, you know... So, but of course, Larry won the fight. But no, it was so. Larry made all of us be there all the time, even if we weren't working. So we really, and we had a month of rehearsal at the Columbia lot before we did the movie.
Wow. So you guys really knew each other. I mean, that was the intent.
Yeah, other than those of us who had dated each other, we and there was an epilogue which we actually shot first down in Atlanta, where we were all in the seedy old house that we shared on the campus.
Oh, I heard about that.
Of the University of Michigan.
Right, but it was hard with the costumes, right?
No, well, I mean, you could say Jeff Goldblum all of a sudden had a huge beard and because it was time when everybody was demonstrating.
Right. And wasn't Costner in it at that time? Was Kevin Costner?
Kevin Costner was alive.
Right.
You saw him alive. And
he played the dead guy. And
he's the dead guy. He's
film.
The body in the beginning of the movie. But I think it was because it opened up such a can of worms. It was actually the part that made me weep when I read the script, because it was a bunch of young friends who did not know what life was going to do to them. Didn't know that one of them was going to die by suicide. And I felt it. I always find that dynamic incredibly moving. But I think it just opened up too much. And no one's ever seen it.
The flashback.
The flashback, yeah.
It's interesting that he's kept it under wraps. I guess he's got it. I know he listens to this show
I'm
sometimes.
I'm sure he does.
I know his kids.
He's the best. Jake. He's just the best. He and Meg, his wife.
Yeah.
They're wonderful people. Yeah.
So, well, obviously we can't go through every movie, but it seems like I love The Natural. That's one of my, I watch it whenever I can. I don't know what it is about that movie, but I just love it. I love it. Like, and apparently I didn't realize that the end, in the end, he doesn't, in the book, he doesn't, it's not the way
it ends. The book, he strikes out. Yeah. The difference between movies and having, you can't have Robert Redford strike out.
But also, like,
it wouldn't have been a hit if he striked out.
Right. But I think Levinson was honoring, like, he was very, like, you know, whatever that book was meant to imply, that this was a hero story from the beginning, you know, all the way through. It's a Homeric tale.
Yeah.
So he's got to hit the home run. I mean,
and what a moment. Isn't it fabulous?
Yeah.
And the music, it's a beautiful score.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. But like Fatal Attraction was this huge cultural phenomenon where you defined the worst fear of every man alive. And it holds, I think.
Yeah, it does hold. Yeah.
You set the standard.
Yeah, I'm proud of that.
Yeah. You are proud, right?
Hard to get dates, but I'm proud of Fatal Attraction.
It was a hell of a role. I mean, how do you make that person a human? What was your
secret? Oh, my God. That probably was the movie that I did most research on.
Really?
Because I wanted to know if her behavior was possible. So I took that script to two different psychiatrists. And it's amazing to me now that they didn't come up with any kind of mental illness or disorder.
Uh-huh.
But who I was playing...
Yeah.
From that research is somebody who had been incested at a very early age by her father.
Right.
There's all that weirdness about her father.
Uh-huh.
And when that happens, many people like that, I mean, a disturbing percentage will do themselves in.
Uh-huh.
This is a woman who was made into a sex object before she even knew what sex was.
Right.
And then made to be feel it was secret and shameful. So you have, she was incapable of having a healthy relationship. It triggered, I mean, that character was used by Dr. Gunderson, who has since passed, but he was kind of the guru of borderline personality disorder research. He said he used that as an extreme case
of borderline,
which could be triggered by what she had gone through in the past. So I was playing a woman who was damaged and in need of help and acting out. For her, the last thing Alex Forrest was to me was a villain.
Right.
But because... It's interesting. You don't get her backstory at all. You don't really understand. There was also a scene that was cut out where she discovered she was actually pregnant. Mm. She's not just so. in that scene where I'm turning the light on and off, we put that in to remind people that I was a human being in pain that should have been at the end of the movie. Anyway.
Right.
I could talk about it forever.
No, but I think that's interesting that, like, the way culturally it gets framed is like, you know, what a monster, where, you know, I didn't feel that because it was played, you know, so emotionally truthfully that, you know, she clearly had problems, but, you know, she was not at fault in her emotional reaction to being used.
Well, she originally killed herself.
At the
end? The original ending was that she cut her throat.
God.
to Madame Butterfly. And,
my God.
Which is the opera that they didn't shoot the scene where she's at the opera and you see Madame Butterfly doing the same thing. But anyway, it would not have been a hit if they hadn't changed the ending. Changing the ending for me was a profound, it was profoundly difficult. I learned from that the importance, what the audience, you know, was crying for was catharsis, was closure. And they wanted me, like Dangerous Liaisons, they wanted her punished more than, you know, it's like women who overkill because if he's alive, they'll kill him, her. You know, it's just, it's people needed the assurance that order would be restored. Huh. And that's what the new ending gave that movie. And I think that's why it was a big hit.
Yeah. So you're not thrilled with that decision, but you understand it.
I understand it. It was very, I fought against it for like 3 weeks. I said, I won't do that to my character. And then finally I was told, as one would, it won't be released if we don't do another ending. They had done a lot of testing. It's kind of a famous incident, the testing and all that.
Well, so that when you dig in with, like, you know, the, with how do you say it?
Mama
Vance. Or somebody like, you know, Alex Forrest and stuff. Then, like, you know, you played Norma Desmond a lot. You know, that, now, I guess there's a wealth of weird narcissistic sadness there that you have to play, honestly, as well, right?
Yeah. Oh, my God. I hope to do her on film and then I can put her to rest. But, yes, I've always been attracted to people who believe in something that we know as an audience is unattainable.
Right.
But that belief, even if it's, I don't know the word to use, crazy, there's something noble about it. There's something noble about it. And also people, what's really, really important is that those characters don't have any self-pity. There is nothing I hate more than self-pity.
Yeah.
That's what I loved about the story of Albert Nobbs, this woman who had this dream of finding love and having a little chocolate shop, and we knew it would never happen, but her belief makes her heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And same with Norma Desmond. Her belief finally does her in for all many different reasons, but there's something incredibly moving about someone clinging to something that feeds them, but we know that it's going to be a disaster.
Yeah, we're seeing it on the presidential level right now.
Oh my God! Whoa!
Not as heartbreaking that story. But also, like, I read that you played Blanche once.
I did in London.
So, like, that's another character. What's it for you? What was at the core of that character?
Oh, my God. PTSD.
Mm.
I thought, I'm fascinated by the why of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So why was she like that?
Mm.
She famously has that incredible speech about watching her lover or her fiancé, who is obviously gay, kill himself in front of her, put a gun to his head and blow his head off.
Right.
There's no trauma worse than that. It was never, PTSD, if it's not treated, becomes only worse and people relive it in their minds. So she heard the music that was playing. She hears the gunshot and she starts self-medicating. To me, that was Blanche DuBois.
Wow. That makes sense.
Yeah, it made sense to me.
And so then is it just fun to play Cruella? Is that like, infuse her with some sort of psychology?
Yeah, well, first of all, I was so thrilled to be a Disney witch after my childhood. And knowing in fairy tales, kids have to know that there's darkness and that they can be rescued from it or that they can rescue themselves from it. So I think the great fairy tales have children who don't have a mother because a mother would not let it happen. And who get, there's a wicked witch or a wicked stepmother. The fathers are usually not there or very distant, like Bambi, or oblivious, like the Little Mermaid. Yeah, I mean, there's all these. So the father's not there, and it's about rescuing the children and bringing them back into the light. And that was, again, you know, instead of children, it was the Dalmatian puppies. And I learned very early on that the meaner she was, the funnier she was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you could really push it.
And the original movie has, I mean, she, this original movie that says, you know, poison them.
Yeah.
Drown them, poison them. It was, they didn't step back from doing, saying stuff like that.
So what happens now? We're all just waiting in COVID land. Do you have work coming up?
I do. And I've been here since February, so I'm kind of freaking out.
Are you going to go? Like, I just took a little part in a movie, and I'm scared about the COVID thing is just like,
I know, making me, especially now.
It's worse than ever. And now they're like, but they got protocols and stuff, but I'm still like, oh, fuck. I don't know. What does that mean? It's like, until they get a test that they can just, we can just do at home every morning. How do we, you know?
I know. I don't know.
Well, are you going to go work?
I'm supposed to go down to LA for 10 days to do a voice for an animated feature. And
oh, that's doable.
Yeah.
Just go into the bunker. That can be pretty clean.
And then, but you have to stay somewhere. And anyway, then in the new year, I'm supposed to go. Well, actually, I miss Christmas because I've got to go quarantine in Canada to do a movie.
2 weeks in Canada?
Year. To quarantine? 2 weeks, absolute.
Vancouver?
Yeah.
That's a great city.
Yeah, it is.
It's pretty. It's like a toy city. It looks like it was all built from the same box.
The human is a, you know, I've done two movies there, you know, quite a while ago, but I really liked it. It'll be interesting to go back. I'm sure it's very different.
Yeah, I'd like to live there, I think.
Yeah. Well,
we'll see.
But anyway, they're very, very strict. And they,
well, that's
so
good.
I'm taking my Pip, my dog.
And this movie's going to open up soon and people are going to be blown away. Great job.
Thank you.
On the Hillbilly Elegy. It was nice talking to you.
It's nice talking to you. Did you we cover things that you wanted to cover? We kind of got hung up in the beginning.
I think so. Like, you know, usually, like, you know, I like the beginning. I think it's, you know, it's interesting to, when you have the time to do a long conversation, that some you kind of get a sense of how somebody either was put together or put themselves together. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it all kind of you know, reveal something. And you know, we covered a few movies, a few plays, your craft, your childhood, your shame. Your sensitivity to psychological motivations, to behavior, your physical choices, Montana, the presidency, working during COVID. We've covered a lot briefly.
This is the first time I actually have come out with a political opinion, because I was very disillusioned by Clinton. And I really worked for first Clinton campaign. And then I thought, you know, ugh. But this, I could not be silent, you know, so.
Yeah, it's, no, I mean, it's crazy.
No, it's
toxic, horrendous. It's
toxic.
Embarrassing, and it's sort of like, how is this fucking real?
But the thing is that they've, you know, the Republicans have laid for years this groundwork of course.
And they don't care about him.
No,
he's just like,
don't.
It's all about
power, staying in power.
And also, he's running, like, they're like, let him do his dance, and we can chip away at the agenda we've been diligently working on for 30 years. And what the,
you know, our founding fathers, and many people feel that the Constitution, I mean, it's amazing that we still are adhering to it, but it's an old piece of writing. But our founding fathers never banked on professional politicians.
That's true.
That, you know, you're supposed to go serve and go home. And now they're these men that have to stay in power, and to stay in power, they have to get money, and to get money, they get corrupted.
Well, they knew that there would be problems with people who were politicians.
Yeah, and they tried to think of you know.
I just talked to Heidi Schreck. Have you seen that show?
Yes, and I listened to that. I listened to that whole thing. It was really,
great,
really
right?
Great, yeah.
Did you watch this? Did you go watch the show?
What an interesting woman.
Yeah. Have you watched the show?
I went to her show on Broadway.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
It was so funny because I was so like, you know, Yeah, the title of it was sort of alienating to me.
Yeah, it was. I know when you said in the beginning, I don't want to go to school. Yeah, no, yeah, yeah. It's true.
But it was really great.
It was great.
I think this is an opportunity, hopefully, for all of us to sort of somehow not be complacent and have a deeper engagement with the civic process. You know,
I really agree. And what I really hope is that we should have some sort of a truth and reconciliation. We have to, now that it's, the scab has been pulled off of the racism in this country, we have to address it. And I think at that point, we will make our Constitution real for everyone. Right now, it's not.
Yeah,
and it never has been because of the racism that has existed from the beginning. That was my, you know, we're taught that we didn't. It didn't really sink in,
right?
Until the whole Black Lives Matter movement, which is to validate ourselves and to finally kind of grow up in a way. That sounds presumptuous to even say that, but I mean that to really have our Constitution truthful and meaningful and strong and important for all of us. We have to deal with these issues, and I hopefully we'll have the enlightened leadership that will help us do that.
Yeah, and we can hold back authoritarianism for a while. Yeah.
You know, we're not a pretty species in huge groups. We're just not.
Yeah, that can go, yes.
Yeah.
So it could be an audience or it could be a political movement.
We can turn on a dime.
That's for sure. All right. Well, have a good rest of the day.
You too. It's nice to meet you. And congratulations on your podcast. It's fascinating.
Oh, thank you.
I really believe in where you're coming from, and I'm very honored to have talked to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I feel the same way. Very honored to talk to you. I've been a huge fan for a long time.
Thanks a lot.
See you later, Gwen.
Bye-bye.
Wasn't that surprising and good? Wow. Hillbilly Elegy with Glenn Close and Amy Adams is on Netflix now, directed by Ron Howard, who we talked to. Go listen to that. That was an enlightening talk. All right, so let's... I'm playing clean, man. I'm playing clean. Monkey lives, La Fonda lives. I miss you, Lynn Shelton.